No, it's, thank you so much for the graciousness with which you've hosted me so far. We're going to be at round two here. This is the part I like talking about, actually, because we're really going to start with not just doing the analysis. I think sometimes Christians get the bad rap for being the culture's terrible people, as opposed to what's beautiful and good about what's going on out of the world. And I do want to give a shout out to two things. One is a great podcast you might want to watch called, I listen to called Vital Signs. My colleague Cameron McAllister does that one. And it's about finding signs of life, finding signs of hope in the culture. And he's really imbibing in what the scripture says in 1 Peter 3:15, to always find a reason you have for the hope you have. To anyone who asks, but do it with gentleness and with respect. Now that's going to, so my second shout out is the Summit Ministries. You know, Summit's a great place. I'll just tell you this real quick as people sort of settle in and come back into the room. I used to speak at Summit multiple times in the summer. I heard about it over the radio one time, and I thought, there's a place where you can go for 12 straight days and get lectured by J.P. Moreland and Josh McDowell and all these other luminaries that I grew up, not even grew up with, I was a Muslim, but when I became a Muslim, I started to become a Christian from a Muslim background. These are the guys who guided me to that truth. And there's a place you can go and spend 2 weeks with them? For heaven's sake, where was this when I was a kid? Well, apparently it was there. I didn't know that because I was a Muslim. But my schedule got to be crazy. Last year I traveled 200 days. Last year and this year it'll be a little bit less than that on purpose. I purposely decided not to spend 200 days on the road, but it's still about 165 or so days on the road, which makes speaking at Summit very difficult for me to do it multiple times. But I'll tell you this, I have made sure to be there at least once a year. At least once a year, because I very much believe in that ministry. Very much believe in it. Let me give you a short story about Summit, because that goes very well into what I'm going to share with you now. What I'll share now is like the hope that happens, because the anxiety level among our young, the anxiety level and the hopelessness that's pervading our young is so high. I can tell you this, every open forum I go to, without an exception it seems lately, some young person, whether it's a male or a female, and I don't care, seriously, 8 years old up to 30 years old, people who are young adults or people who are just emerging into the double digits of life, ask the question, and sometimes it's this, why should I keep from ending my own life? Suicide is one of the highest asked questions we get. Montana number one or two, that's sad. It's not sad. Sad's a ridiculous word for that. It's abysmally tragic. They ask because of the hopelessness. So I was at Summit 2 years ago, and I was speaking. And I had a talk I gave specifically on, it's called Exposing Truth's Cost, Sharing Truth's Worth. It's about the idea that truth has a price. Changing your worldview has a price to it. But it's worth it. You have to expose the reasons why people don't want to come to faith. And usually it's because there's a price tag associated with becoming a Christian. But I want to show them how it is that it's worth it to become a Christian, even when the price is high, because the gain is so much higher. And a young lady was there and she was listening. Well, about 5 months later, I was speaking in Winnipeg and at another conference altogether, and she happened to be at the conference. And I was talking to people afterward. They were in line talking to me, and this young lady went, recognize. Not a lot of kids at Summit per session. It's about 100 and something kids per session. And she's looking, this is in the line, and she's crying. She's got stacks of notebooks in her hands. They're falling out of her hands. Kind of thing. And she comes up to me finally. She says, hi, Mr. Murray. My name is, and I can't remember her name, honestly, just at this moment. I know her name. I was forgetting at the moment. She said, I was at Summit last year in August. And you said something. And she pulled the very notebook that she was taking notes from that session in. So I'm going to tell you this first. That night, I planned to kill myself. I was going to end my life that night. And you said two things that changed my mind. And you know what's funny? The two things I said aren't all that powerful. It really isn't. I said, the truth has a price, but it's always worth it. Take it from me as someone who's paid the price. And I said, the answers are not hard to find, but they are hard to accept. Will you go through the process? That's when I was convicted. I will go through the process. I'm alive today because I heard you at Summit. I didn't do anything special, but the Lord moved at Summit because it offers hope to very, very hopeless children and hopeless kids and hopeless young adults. It's there. How do we combat the post-truth world? point out the consequences of the post-truth culture, but we also point out the hope. Because once the vacuum is created, they don't want post-truth anymore. And they come to the microphone, they open forums, or they sit down in your kitchen, or they come to you with a desperate situation. Now what do? You offer them the hope that comes from embracing truth once again. You see, the culture wants to shun the Bible away. Because remember, freedom is the chief virtue. Freedom is the chief virtue. And we're now talking about autonomy, no longer freedom. We want to be laws unto ourselves. And we see the Bible as this freedom-destroying document. It's this dusty old book written by dusty old people in dusty old countries where they use God as their justification to say, don't do this behavior, I find that icky. Or, I'm a male, I'll use God, call him a male, to subjugate women. Whatever it might be, that's what they perceive it as. It's a freedom-inhibiting document. It doesn't allow for freedom. Now, they couldn't have it more backwards. They really couldn't have it more backwards. I want to sustain for you in the time we have, in the short time I want to speak now, so that we can get to the questions and the answer period today. What I want to sustain for you is that the Bible is not a freedom-inhibiting document, it is a freedom-defining document. It actually gives us the very definition to freedom that we can live by, but it does stand against autonomy. It does, because autonomy results in chaos. As I said before, when two autonomous beings collide and there's no truth, objective truth above, then we lose all sense of wisdom, integrity, accountability, and human value. And the Bible stands for wisdom, integrity, accountability, and human value. So what do I mean when I say the Bible is a freedom-loving, freedom-espousing, a freedom-establishing document? Do you understand what freedom actually is? Freedom requires boundaries. There's a difference between autonomy and freedom. Autonomy is the ability to do what you want, whenever you want, in whatever way you want. That sounds like freedom, but it's not. Isaiah Berlin actually pointed out that there's two facets to freedom. There's positive freedom and negative freedom. Now, negative freedom isn't a bad thing. It sounds bad if the word negative is in front of it. Think of it this way. It's freedom from restrictions. So when we have negative freedom, it's freedom from government intrusion. It's freedom from powerful, you know, forces that are inhibiting your ability to do what you want to do. That's negative freedom. That's a good thing. But it's not the only thing, because when we have negative freedom only, then we have autonomy, and autonomy is chaos. Positive freedom is the freedom for the greater good, to do what you want so that you can do what you should. There is a boundary around freedom, and that is the greater good, the common good. Not to do just what you want, but to do what you should, and use your God-given abilities to do that. That's both facets of freedom. Talk about one part of freedom without the other is to talk about like a one-ended stick or a one-sided coin. It's ridiculous. We need both. You see, freedom necessarily has boundaries. It was Chesterton who said it so beautifully. Listen to what Chesterton says. He says, even art is a limitation. Even people always think of art as, you know, unlimited, artistic license, as it were, the freedom of art. He says, no, even art is a limitation. The essence of every picture is the frame, after all. If you dare to draw a giraffe, you must draw him with a long neck. If in your bold, creative way, you hold yourself free to draw a giraffe with a short neck, you are really willing to find that you have not drawn a giraffe at all. The moment you step into the world of facts, you step into a world of limits. You can free things from alien or accidental laws, but not from the laws of their own nature. You may, if you like, free a tiger from his bars, but you dare not free him from his stripes. If you free a camel from his humps, you have freedom from being a camel at all. Facts have this funny way of telling us what reality is all about. And if freedom is a part of reality, then facts are a part of freedom, and facts necessarily exclude falsehood. Freedom has boundaries. Let me give you an example of what I mean. So years ago, my wife and I, many years ago, my son's 15 now, and when he was barely a year old, we were thinking about moving. We saw this one house, the house we currently live in, actually. We saw this one house that we really loved. Big backyard. We love our backyard. The kids can play in it and all this. We love this backyard. And at the time, we only had my son, Yusuf. He was our only, not only our oldest. And my wife and I were looking at this place and thought, it's a great price, great neighborhood, great schools. One problem, this backyard backs up to a main road where cars and trucks, and sometimes big, heavy trucks, are whizzing by, you know, at 40, 50 miles an hour. as kid have, my kids playing in the backyard where they could just, the ball will bounce into the street and they won't look because they're kids and they're pulverized. In other words, they won't have the freedom to use the purpose of the backyard. I want you to make sure you remember this connection, freedom and purpose. Unless there was a boundary. Unless there was a boundary beyond which they could not play. Here's the boundary, you can't play beyond this because I don't want the ball to bounce into the street or whatever it is. So we set up a boundary. They couldn't play beyond that. And because of the boundary, just enough of a boundary, not too much, then my kids had the freedom to enjoy the purpose of the backyard. Without the boundary, you couldn't be back there. But with the boundary, you can enjoy its purpose. See how boundaries, just enough, allow you the actual freedoms? Freedom requires boundaries. And the Bible sets those boundaries. It sets boundaries on sexual expression because it wants us to enjoy the purpose and the beauty and the value of human sexuality. Not because it finds it gross or icky or because certain people just are Victorian repressive people or whatever it might be. No, because they actually value human sexuality. They value human relationships. The Bible keeps these things as sacred, and that which is sacred, and I'll share this tomorrow, we'll talk on sexuality, that which is sacred must be protected. And it's fragile, it can whisk away like the wind. Do you recall, maybe you've seen the movie Gladiator, a number of years ago, I think it was early 90s, this movie that's very loosely historical. And it's this, there's this scene where the Emperor Marcus Aurelius is trying to make Rome into a republic again. He wants to take it away from being an empire into a republic and give it back to the people. And he wants to name a new emperor who will be his successor. And he calls upon Maximus, his general, and he says that it's got to be you, because you don't want to be emperor. So it's got to be you, because you'll give up the power once you have it. You'll give it back to the Senate. And he says, there was once a dream that was Rome, that was a republic. But it was so fragile, you could only whisper it, anything more, and it would vanish. Because the fragility of a republic is so fragile that if you yell, it'll disappear. I think the understanding of freedom, the understanding of beauty and purpose of human beings is quite fragile in our day. If you say anything more than a whisper of it, it'll just go away. So the Bible wants to protect that by offering boundaries. I would say even bulwarks, I would say even walls around which that which is beautiful must be protected. And it does it beautifully. So the Bible can be a source, not only of truth, but human freedom. So they're linked together. They're linked together. I want you to hear the words of Jesus in a very familiar passage. Most of you have read this passage many, many times, but oftentimes with the saying goes, familiarity breeds contempt. We sort of lose the luster for that which is unique in a passage simply because we've read it a lot of times. Hopefully you'll see a couple of pairings in Jesus' word that maybe you didn't see before. Because he does offer the world hope, as opposed to the post-truth culture. In John chapter 8, verses 31 and 36, this is what happens. It says this, so Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, these are his followers, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Did you catch it? You will know, not feel, you will know the truth, will set you free. For Jesus, freedom and truth are inextricably linked. You cannot separate the two. Truth and freedom are inseparable. You know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Their response to him is nothing shy of hilarious. They answer him, we are children of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it you say you will become free? Just think about it for a moment how funny that actually is. We are children of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. Did you forget the whole 400 years in Egypt thing? I mean, they celebrate their liberation from Egypt every year at the Passover. Every year. Never been enslaved to anyone. And by the way, do you know when they're saying this? While they're under Roman occupation. You see how powerful your preferences can be in blurring your ability to see the truth? Even the truths you hold dear? Very powerful. Now Jesus, of course, in his inimitable, firm yet gentle, how he does that, it's amazing to me. You know, this one's free. Jesus is remarkable to me because he's the coalescence of all contrarieties. He's God and man. He's the Word made flesh, and he uses words to both convict and to heal at the same exact time. That's why he's the Word. Amazes me. That one was free. Here's his response. Here's his response. He says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin." Egyptian bondage was not the same thing that I'm talking about. You've missed the whole big picture. Slavery to sin is the real slavery. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Did you catch it? Did you see it? Because you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The son will set you free. The son is the truth. He couples all those things together. He says, "I am the truth that sets you free." You can't just say that kind of a thing and let it sit there. You gotta back that kind of a claim up. "You're the truth that sets me free." Who do you think you are? They asked him that, John chapter 2. By what authority do you do these things? And then he made an interesting statement. Jesus made a falsifiable statement. He says, "When you destroy this temple, meaning my body, I will raise it up again in 3 days. Bodily, not spiritually, not symbolically, but bodily. It will not be in the tomb you place it in." That's either true or false, and your opinion is irrelevant. Your preference does not matter. So he claimed to be the one who could set us free. Now, I've debated many a person on the resurrection of Jesus. Many of my colleagues have as well. Sean McDowell, who will be here soon, he did a whole PhD dissertation on the fate of the apostles and how their testimony that they saw the raised Jesus with their own eyes is a wonderful piece of evidence that shows you that there's something that happened to this man named Jesus of Nazareth that warrants our attention. I think that the evidence for the resurrection is so powerful. In fact, it was integral to my becoming a Christian. And I've debated many an atheist on this. I debated John Loftus, the atheist. You can go onto YouTube, our YouTube channel. Look my name up. It's John Loftus, L-O-F-T-U-S, and see our debate on the resurrection. Jesus not only claimed to be the truth who could set us free, but he died on a cross and then rose from the dead to prove he was right. Now, here's the important part. People often ask me, "Why don't you put your faith in Marx, or in Muhammad, or in Buddha, or in Zoroaster, or Confucius?" Here's my reason. They're all still dead. Jesus died and rose from the dead. And a guy who rises from the dead tends to have credibility. He tends to be believable. He claimed to be the one who sets me free. This offers something very important, this very fact upon which the Christianity is based. And I'm going to unpack it at the end, but it offers us a very important fact upon which the entire thing is based, is that we have drifted far from what was intended. Our purpose was to be with God. Our preference was to be God, and that relationship was ruptured because of that. And then Jesus says, "You and I owe a debt to God the Father because of this. Because Jesus has no debts of his own to pay, he can pay yours and mine and everyone's out of the abundance of his infinite goodness and infinite righteousness. He can pay the debt that we owe." And then he says, "I will die on a cross and raise from the dead." If I'm right. You see, if he died on a cross and stayed dead, you would have no reason to believe him. So he says, "I'm paying for your sins." Well, maybe you did, maybe you didn't. I don't know. You're still dead. But if he rises from the dead, you have every reason to believe that he paid for your sins and my sins. This is important because it offers us a global hope and a personal hope. The global hope is this. You know, Mark Twain was once credited as saying, I don't know if it was him or not, but he's credited with the statement, "History does not repeat, but it sure does rhyme." I think he's right. I think he's right. When you look at the inception of the Christian movement, at the inception of the Christian movement, Christians were being persecuted by Rome. So much so that the pagan emperor eventually at one point said, "It is a mockery, it is a travesty that the insipid Galileans," meaning Christians, "are not only caring for those in their own ranks, but they care for the sick and the injured and the weak in our ranks, in our pagan ranks." He was shamed by this. The Emperor Julian was. He was saying these Christians help everybody, even those who hate them. And then you fast forward a few hundred years, and you find the plague ships teetering off the coasts. because they wouldn't allow to go onto the docks because everyone feared plague would infect their towns as well. It was Christians who got on their skiffs or whatever it was they got on, went over to those boats and ended up ministering to people, even if they got plague themselves, they did that. Fast forward another few hundred years and you find Christian doctors going over to West Africa, in Ebola-infested Africa, to treat people who have no hope of treatment other than their treatments, and they are willing to get Ebola themselves. History does not repeat, but it does rhyme. I'm not saying Christians alone are responsible for the good of the world. What I am saying is that it is a natural outworking of Christianity that allows people to be this way, to be selfless like this. It was David Bentley Hart in his book, Atheist Delusions, where he actually spoke about this. He said, this idea of freedom, this idea of speaking and caring for the indigent and the poor was not so much laughable to our pagan ancestors as it was incomprehensible. They didn't even think of the idea. The idea that we could be all equal and that everyone deserves fair treatment, that wasn't considered even an idea to laugh at. It wasn't an idea at all to the Romans. In fact, you know the word person that we have? The word person is from the Latin word persona, which means mask. It means something artificial put on you. The state gave you personhood because of your citizenship or your service or your riches or your property. Being born wasn't enough to be a person in the Roman Empire's eyes. And then I can quote directly for you when it was that Peter Singer said, being born does not qualify you for personhood. History doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. But it was this idea of equality, David Bentley Hart says, that was born from the Christian idea that all men, all human beings, every single person, male, female, whatever it was, all people were equally sinners, equal, but all offered equal redemption. That's when equality was really born. And we've been basking in the light of that ever since. Yet we say that Christianity somehow is to blame for all the injustice in the world. Christianity is the one that fights it. Now, Christians have been the progenitors of injustice. It's not because they've been consistent with Christ's message, but because they're inconsistent with it and flew in his face and used it as a mockery. But it offers a global hope. We see it all over the world. In fact, so much so, let me read to you this quote. I'm almost done, and we can get to our questions and answer period. Matthew Paris is an atheist writer. He was born in Africa, and he goes back to Africa, and he writes, what he sees there causes him to write an article. It's called, Why Africa Needs Christianity. This is what this atheist says. Listen to his words very carefully to show the global hope of Christianity. He says, before Christmas I returned, after 45 years, to the country that as a boy I knew as Nyasaland. Today it's Malawi. It inspired me, renewing my flagging faith in development charities. But traveling in Malawi requests another belief too. One I've been trying to banish all my life, but an observation I've been unable to avoid since my African childhood. It confounds my beliefs, stubbornly refuses to fit my worldview, and has embarrassed my growing belief that there is no God. Now as a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution Christian evangelism, not the work, the message, makes in Africa, sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, it is the Christian message that changes people's hearts. The transformation is real. The rebirth is good. Global hope. Then it funnels down, my friends, to a very personal hope. A very personal hope. I have so many stories I can share with you about this. So many stories. I don't have time to be able to give you even, likely even one, to say this one. I was sitting with an African-American young man, very, very bright man, and he was adopted by a white family, believers in God. He quickly became disillusioned with God. He found his birth father. His birth father was a very angry, militant guy who thought that Christianity was the enslaver's religion. It was the white man's religion that was subjugated to black man. And so he became an atheist over the whole thing, and this young man followed suit. And we sat down for 4 hours over pizza discussing how Christianity is racist. And I pointed out that even the word racist doesn't make any sense unless there's a God. Because if we're all just chemical blobs, you can't be racist if it's a chemical blob. But if there's something more to us than just chemical reactions and synapses firing, then there's something transcendent about us, and that's when we can be outraged at inequality and injustice. And he eventually agreed with me. In fact, 3 weeks later, he sent me a card saying our discussion really helped. Today, I'm in an Anglican church in Bibleforce. Offers a real hope. Is anger dissipated? His hope is kindled. A very personal hope. Tomorrow, I'll share a little bit about how that personal hope can translate to how we talk to people who are struggling with sexual identity and gender issues and all these things, the biggest issues of our day. It really, really reaches people on a very personal level. The kids who come to us after the university and in forums and speak to us, I've met so many in the Lord on the phone or right there at the end of the dais. I want you to come in one of these one time, just to come and see. It's remarkable, the Lord does. It's remarkable. You see, I'm going to close with this quote. Despite all the hope the gospel can offer, the post-truth culture is trying to bury it by saying, you don't need truth, you just need satisfaction. You just need your preferences met. And so you can put your faith not in things that are true, but in things that are personal. It doesn't work, because we put our faith now in things that aren't even personal, let alone true. It was a secular band called Crash Parallel, a Canadian band, who wrote a song called Rain Noise. Listen to the words of the song. This is not a Christian band. They specifically capture what's wrong with our society today and why we need someone outside of ourselves to save us from us. This is what they said. Sleepless nights and endless days, mini skirts and surgery trays, waking up from rain delays and selling sex for pocket change, and living off the alcohol with no one but a cab to call, lost inside a bathroom stall, this carbon copy life withdrawal. And limousines and cigarettes and chasing dreams and fishing nets and long weekends without regrets. Well, no one here is taking bets. It's enough. They say, I need someone to believe in. Someone to fill this space with grace. Someone to look into my eyes and touch my face. Someone to make me strong. Someone to make me belong. Someone to make me alive. Not stuff, not experience, not career, not preferences, a person. A person. Jesus claims 2,000 years ago to be the way, the truth, and the life. And for 2,000 years, we've been trying to fulfill our lives through our own ways, mishmashing the truth, and finding nothing but death. My hope is that over the course of this session, together, whether tonight and tomorrow, you will be equipped to be able to share with the world their personal pursuits. Don't give them truth, nor does it give them freedom. And it's Jesus who gives them freedom, because in him, the truth is a person. God bless you guys. We'll take the questions.
Please come to the mic, identify yourself, ask the question, try and keep it under 30 seconds.
And don't wait, you don't have to wait for someone else to finish. If you want to come to the mic, just line up. It would be great. So let's hear it. All right, let's hear it.
I'm going to identify myself. I'm Avonlea. Nice to meet you. So what my question is, and just really quick for some background, I was talking to him prior to this, just in the break, is I grew up in Montana, and we have amazing, really Bible-believing teaching churches here. And then I briefly moved to the East Coast, to New York City, saw a lot of his counterparts speak with Tim Keller and the foundation conferences that they would do, and they were brilliant. And what I noticed there in the years living there, of the churches that I went to, most of them were very large mega churches, and they weren't all fundamentally Bible-teaching church, so believing the whole Bible to its entirety. And so what my question is I'm 29 years old, and what I'm seeing is these churches that are moving in a direction where, yes, Jesus loves you, come get saved, but you really don't need to live a crucified life. And if Christianity is living a crucified life, and we have these churches rising up and not addressing that, and really not teaching the Bible to its entirety and addressing the real issue, which is the sin in the heart, it's a heart issue. How long do you see the Bible teaching churches like a Redeemer standing against these churches that are rising up and metastasizing so quickly with these followings of people my age who probably haven't spent any time reading their Bible and really know biblical truth?
Yeah. You know, I can appreciate the force of the question because it's something that you begin to observe all the time in culture. So I want to tell you, say thank you, Adam, because it's something you all have to deal with and all wrestle with. Because there's a microcosm here. That's the macrocosm that we might see in American and Western churches, where we see churches that aren't, you know, sticking to the fundamentals of the Bible. But then, doesn't that happen within our even Bible-believing churches? So within our Bible-believing churches, we're seeing people who aren't sticking to it, or they have an easy believism or a traditionalism. Why do you come to church? I come to church because I'm supposed to, kind of a thing. And they might come to a Bible-believing church but never have any of that teaching actually soak into them. So it's a macro problem and a micro problem. So I don't want to paint it worse than you painted it, but I don't want to make it easier than it is either. It's a very difficult question. Here's what I would say. I'm often very reticent, by the way, to pick on the body of Christ. I think sometimes we're a little too eager to pick on the body of Christ and say, well, churches today, you know, not my church, though, my church is great. And somehow everyone's church is always the greatest problem in the church. So someone's church isn't doing great. But I'm very reticent to actually to poke fun at the church or to criticize her too much. Here's the reason why. She is the body of Christ. There is no plan B. So I want to take it soberly and also point out there are some churches that are doing a great job and you mentioned one in specific, but there are many churches. I was just at the Brooklyn Tabernacle in New York doing a Skeptics Night. They have a Skeptics Night where we have an initiative where we come in, we invite skeptics to come into a special service with all of we talk for 10 minutes, and then just questions and answers from skeptics. And they come to the Lord and all these things. So a lot of people are doing great jobs, but some are not, because there is a sense in which people want to please other people and have them come in and fill the butts in the seats. If you have enough butts in the seats, then we'll have enough salvations where we can work them as well. And there's no real discipleship program either. So they get them saved, but saved to what? Robbie's often had this statement. He says, what you win them with is what you win them to. If you win them with a concert, you'll win them to a concert. If you win them with the Lord, you'll win them to the Lord. So that's a very important thing for us to imbibe and understand. But before we stand in righteous judgment of those churches, we have to realize sometimes of our own shortcomings. So I point out in the book, by the way, in chapter 2, it's specifically about the church and the post-truth culture. There's two things we have to watch out for. Part of the church wants the Bible or wants Christianity to be so palatable to the culture that we water down the very difficult things. We water down the idea of the cost of discipleship and following Jesus is hard, not only publicly, but it's hard privately. We have to subdue our own desires and die to ourselves, live the crucified life that you said. That's a hard message to swallow. Jesus never made things easy, did he? I mean, think about the recruiting poster he has. It's a horrible recruiting poster when you think about it. He says, hey, in Matthew 15, verse 19, he says, hey, you're all evil, you're horrible, murder's in your hearts, come follow me. I mean, you know what every other religion teaches? That if you do enough good things, or you work off your karma, you will eventually become enlightened, or you will please God, and you will enter into his heaven based on your merits. That's a wonderful message to sell people if you want them to feel good about themselves. You are good enough to please God. Jesus says, you are incapable of pleasing God, but I can, and I'll do it for you. See, Jesus is not a salesman who tells you what you want to hear. He's the kind of person who tells you what you need to hear. Makes him professionally honest. The church needs to be that, once again. So we can't go to this watered-down version of the gospel where we take difficult verses, whether it's on marriage, or it's on the self-crucified life, or whatever it might be, and water them down to make it easier for people to come into the doors. But we can't have the pendulum swing the other way either, where we make everything about bashing people or making it legalistic or so hard to be a Christian that someone says, why in the world are you telling me this? We can't do that either. The balance is in the middle, that his yoke is easy and his burden is light. but in this life you will have trouble, but take heart, for I have overcome the world. How do you reconcile both those things? One's about the ultimate hope in salvation, the other one is about enduring this life so that when that salvation comes, he can look at you and say, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into my rest. I think churches need to recapture the beauty of hardship once again. You see, here's the thing about post-truth culture, and we'll go on to the next question after this. The thing about a post-truth culture is it does a great job, this is the good thing about it, it does a great job of weeding people out who don't need it. You know, the Pew Research polls show us that people are, the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people who say that they're spiritual but not religious, or they don't like organized religion. You know what that is? That's not a new fad. We're not getting a rise of people who didn't believe before. We're getting people who have given up the pretense of saying they were Christian when they didn't mean it. They've been saying it all along, didn't mean it in the first place. So now we're finding out who the real believers actually are. And that's fine, because now we can rally the troops. See, the post-truth culture says this: it is going to be very difficult to be a Christian, because when you say Christian things, we don't like it, we're going to shut you up. But here's the fun thing about this: it will not be boring. When we were Christians in a very easy believism time, we were background noise. Now, they're not liking what we say, but they are hearing what we say. Think hard in that. The church never expanded when it was easy, always expanded when it was being persecuted. Great question, thank you. Yes, please.
I'm very short. So my question is, would you present the same types of arguments for, or when you're talking to people who say they're agnostic, or those who grew up in the faith and then walked away?
Sure.
Would you present the same types of arguments with?
Penny, isn't it? Well, thanks, Penny. That's a good question. And it kind of depends on why they're agnostic or why they walked away from their faith. See, most people won't go around saying, I'm post-truth. I'm a post-truth person. I prefer my preferences over facts. People don't do that. Because they look ludicrous, right? I mean, no one says, I don't care about facts. No one says that. But their life tends to show that. By the way, that's a human thing. There's a cognitive phenomenon called confirmation bias. Everyone is subject to confirmation bias. If I have, let's say I have a view on the death penalty, and I'm anti-death penalty and someone else is pro-death penalty, I'm not saying which one I am, I'm just using it as an example, so don't take it too far. And we look at the same amount of evidence, the same kind of evidence. Confirmation bias tells me that I will interpret that same evidence as a way that somehow favors my position. And the person who's pro will interpret that evidence in a way that favors their position. Because that's a human cognitive trait called confirmation bias. The trick is to get rid of it, to recognize it exists, and then to wrestle with it all the time. And almost no one does that, because almost no one believes they're susceptible to it, when we're all susceptible to it. So I think that's the first thing, is to understand, why is someone agnostic? Why does somebody walk away from the faith? And the only way to do that is to ask them questions. So when someone says, I'm agnostic, I ask them this question: what do you mean by agnostic? Because there's two different kinds of agnostic. Actually, there's many different kinds, but the two main ones. There's a hard agnostic and a soft agnostic. A hard agnostic is someone who says, we can't know if there's a God. We simply cannot know. So my question back to the hard agnostic is this: how do you know you can't know? Because if you're so willing to say you don't know, are you willing to say that you don't know if you can't know? See the problem with hard agnosticism? It's not agnostic enough. What a soft agnostic would say, I don't yet know, but I'm willing to go where the evidence leads. Now that I can deal with. That's a skeptic. You see, the important thing here is to remember this. There's a difference, friends, between being a skeptic and being a cynic. A cynic is somebody who doesn't believe unless there's enough evidence. Sorry, no, what did I say? A skeptic is somebody who doesn't believe unless there's enough evidence. A cynic is somebody who won't believe even when there is. So you look at Pilate. Pilate was a cynic. He says, what is truth? And he walks out, doesn't want the answer. But you look at Thomas, who's a skeptic. Even John the Baptist was a skeptic. He says, are you the one who comes before another? Those people were skeptics. Thomas was a skeptic. And what does Jesus do? He rewards them with evidence. He says, your heart is right. You don't yet fully come to terms with the belief, but your heart is right. And what does he do with Thomas? He walks in the locked door. It's locked. Thomas is hiding from his life. He walks through the locked door with his glorified body and looks at Thomas and says, puts him in the scars and says, Shalom Alechem, peace be unto you. He's, as if he's saying, my crucifixion and resurrection, this is your peace. Stop worrying so much. And then Thomas falls to his knees, says, my Lord and my God, and then goes and martyrs himself in India, preaching the gospel there. Because he's not a cynic, he's a skeptic. And skeptics can get rewarded with the evidence. They're truly real skeptics. So what I would say is that if someone claims to be agnostic and they walk away from the faith, put your arm alongside them and say, why? What happened? What caused that? Sometimes it's an emotional trauma. Sometimes it's a personal anecdote. Who knows what it might be? Maybe it's a question you didn't get answered. I was at a speaking somewhere, and a couple came up to me and they said to me, you know, my son's been coming to all your sessions. I was doing classes every single day. He says, my son's an atheist, an avowed atheist. He's coming to all your classes for some reason. And I asked him why. He said, well, Dad, because he answers my questions. So don't you? He says, no, I'm in the military. We don't ask questions about that. So it was unfair. He says, that's how I was raised. You believe it. Bible says it. I believe it. That settles it. And I'm like, well, if you want to make your son an atheist, you're doing a good job. Because he has questions. He's got a keen mind. And we spoke, and he said at the end of the conversation, thank you, answer all my questions. So I would ask somebody why. Bring your arm around them. Walk alongside them and find out why they're agnostic. And sometimes it's because they don't want to believe. By the way, agnostic sounds deep. Atheist sounds harsh. There is no God. And agnostic sounds like, I'm open. Are you really? That's the real question. And see if facts matter more than their preferences. So I think I would present those kind of arguments as well. And in fact, I don't know if it's the pitch for the book, but in the book, I go into science and religion. I'll go into that tomorrow. I go into various areas about how religious belief, specifically Christian beliefs, belief, makes sense of the world that all of us, including agnostics, are trying to make sense of. I hope that helps. But ask the questions why, and you'll find out where you should go with that. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Hello, my name is Raymond Porter. Start off by saying I don't like lawyers.
Oh, all right.
particularly because I don't like Greek and Latin. I just don't trust language that I don't speak. So when, in John 8, you will know the truth. The truth will set you free. What Greek or Hebrew word we now translate as free? Is there a hidden? Is there an additional meaning? Because Jesus obviously couldn't have said free. Mm-hmm. If we're getting into parsing out freedom versus autonomy, kind of your whole thesis.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a clarification there?
Sure. Let me look it up. Because I don't like to speak when the Bible does not speak, and I won't try my best not to do this. Hold on a sec. Here's a sec. There we go.
Also, your stance on the death penalty, but you raised that question.
Oh. Nice try.
Well, he's looking. Because guys like this, Jay Warner Wallace, and so forth, to have apps that answer these questions for you.
So let's go to John 8:31. And let's go to the passage specifically. John 8:36 sets you free. Okay. I'm going to look at this word. Here we go. And we'll search. So it's Eleutherio, okay, in Greek. And it basically means to be free from bondage.
Is that similar enough to autonomy?
No, because it's not. Because autonomy, like I said, has two Greek root words. So the root for autonomous is autonomous. like, you know what's funny about the word for, you know what the word for moron is in Greek? Moron. But the autonomy is autonomy, autonomia, or autonomio in Greek. So this is speaking of to be set free from bondage, to be caused to be set free. And there's a number of other connotations for it, but autonomy is two root words, autos. Whenever you see the word himself or hisself or self, it's autos. And nomos is always law. So it really means to be a law unto yourself. Now, if you look at this definition of autonomous in the dictionary, you'll see free. You will see that. But what I'm saying is that if you look at a proper, like the root of it, not just the derivations of autonomy, but the root of autonomy, it does come from this idea of being a law unto yourself. We have autonomous vehicles, right? we're talking about autonomous vehicles now. So language can be used univocally, equivocally, or analogically. And sometimes the same word can be used all three ways. So a univocal meaning of the language is that it's used in one way and one way only. Equivocal can mean that it can be used multiple ways in different contexts depending on how you're talking about it. So when I say autonomous vehicle, now is it really autonomous? Does the vehicle go where it wants? No, it means it doesn't have to be driven. But you plug it into the GPS and it'll go there without you driving it. It's not actually autonomous. In fact, I would say it's actually less autonomous than a vehicle that is just like, got no driver at all, the brakes are bad. Right? That goes where it wants because of physics. But an autonomous vehicle, I see what I'm saying, we use language differently and univocally and equivocally sometimes. What I'm saying is in the truest sense of the word, to be truly autonomous would be to be self-law or self-governed, utterly, without, devoid of God. And so what I was getting at here is, so a young man asked this question, not your question, but it factors into your question. At Yale University, I gave the same talk, and a young man at Yale University came up, bright guy like yourself, and he said, I see how truth leads to freedom, but how is it that Jesus leads to freedom? I mean, because you said he's the truth that sets us free, how does that work? And what I was pointing out to him is that true freedom is very different than autonomy, because Jesus claims that you were created for a purpose, and that purpose is to be in communion with God. And our preference is to be God. That would be autonomous. We have no boundaries whatsoever on us. Freedom is not autonomy, because freedom is the ability to do what you want based on what you should, because there is a moral law above us, in accordance with what you are. That's an important distinction here. Freedom is the ability to do what you want based on what you should in accordance with what you are. And what you are, on Jesus' lips, is someone made in God's image. You are not a cosmic accident. If you were a cosmic accident, you either have no autonomy because you're basically subject to your desires and chemical firings, or you're completely autonomous because there's no rules to guide you. But that's not free. So I think that this gives me so I'm trying to talk about what I think to be fully orbed view of freedom in the context when Jesus says this word for freedom, he immediately juxtaposes it with slavery to sin. So you do what you want. See what he's saying? He's saying in John chapter 8, verses 33, 34, and 35, he's saying you're a slave to sin, which means you do what you want. Sin is not something you accidentally fall into. It's you do what you want, but you're a slave to what you want. That's autonomy. And true freedom is to do what you should based on what you are. And the Son sets you free, that kind of thing. It's a complicated answer, but your question is very subtle, and I appreciate the depth of your question, because it was a good question. It really was. In fact, you're the first person ever to ask me that. And I get a lot of questions, so you win a prize thing. Thanks very much. Thank you. Yes, please.
My name's Hannah, and my question is not so much about the post-truth issues, but your view on Christians' response to a political issue or the political climate.
Mm-hmm.
As a former Muslim, I think you could speak to this issue.
Yeah.
You know, with 9/11 just occurring, and you know, Trump's position on Islam and all these things, it almost seems like Christianity and Islam are pitted as mortal enemies, or there's this apocalyptic implications to the relationship.
Yeah.
And so, as a Christian, I don't always know how to view that or how to interact, you know, with a Muslim, or what should our voice be? Because it seems,
yeah,
you know, I don't know how we should respond as Christians to that relationship,
well,
Islam and America.
What's your name again?
Hannah.
So there's this tendency now in our current political climate and our social climate, to circle the wagons. You know, so we clutter together, cluster together, I should say, in groups. So Muslims do this, Christians do this, Jews do this, agnostics do this, atheists do this, and they are always wrong, and we're always right, and all these things. And we lose a sense of gospel in that. We lose a sense of mission in that. You know, when you circle the wagons, you can't go out. You don't reach out into the world. It's just something that is called up, we're all called upon to do. So no matter what you think of a Muslim, or Islam as a religion, or Hinduism as a religion, or whatever it might be, you are still called to go to those people. So here's what I would say as a fundamental principle about Christians should think about political ideas, social ideas, and religious ideas. Here's the fundamental principle. Not every idea is deserving of your respect, but every person who holds them is, because they are made in God's image. The Bible does not say some are made in His image. It doesn't say white people are made in His image. It doesn't say black people. It doesn't say liberals. It doesn't say Republicans. It doesn't say that. It says, let us make humanity in our image after our own likeness. That's everyone. So when I engage in a political idea, when I think about whether certain ideas, whether it's Obamacare or it's this thing, it's a policy, heavy policy thing, the first question I ask myself is this: have I engaged with a person I disagree with in a way where they would bet their eye teeth that I thought they were made in God's image? If the answer is no, then try again. And all of us have failed at that. Every one of us. We had a heated moment, or whatever it might be. I think that's the problem with all the rancor we see today, with all the vitriol and all this, is we don't see people as made in God's image anymore because we've sacrificed truth on the altar of our preferences. So you're actually asking a very post-truth related question, because what I said before was, if we lack accountability or even lack integrity, we start to see people as less than they actually are. We treat them as less. So honestly, if I see one more video that says conservative A destroys liberal, and you know, I'm just going to throw up. I mean, do you really, you know what the Bible says? The Bible specifically says that we are to destroy arguments and every idea that raises itself against the knowledge of God. Doesn't say you are to destroy people. So as a Christian, when I think about political ideas, the first thing I think about is, how am I engaging with my opponents? Second thing I think about is, why do I oppose my opponents? Do I assume the worst in them? That they're those lousy baby killers, they love killing babies. Well, maybe some of them do. But does this particular person who's pro-life actually love baby death? Maybe not. Maybe they actually think that this is not a baby's diet. Maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe they do. I don't know. But you know how to find out? Conversing. Not yelling. Paul the Apostle makes this glorious statement. And this is the way I govern all my ministry. Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. One of my favorite passages in the Bible. He says, walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Now, he doesn't mean be efficient. He's Middle Eastern. He's not efficient in his time. What he means is, talk about what they care about. And then he says this wonderful statement. This is something that we need sorely in our day. He says, let your speech be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. Did you notice what he said at the last thing? He didn't say how you ought to answer each controversy, each question, each policy, each political issue. You want to answer people. May you never answer a question. Always answer a person. Persons need answers. Questions don't need answers. People do. And people use questions, and they use policy, they use issues to get at their deeply felt needs. If you answer people, you will never fail. You might not succeed the whole 100%. But if you have them in heart, you will get there eventually. I think as we engage in political issues, we have to look at them as people who need the same Savior that we need. Because don't forget something. They, those godless, unsaved, whatever's, we were they at one point. Because you weren't born a Christian, you were born again a Christian. So before you judge that, remember, you were they too. And I think that makes it. One more question. Okay. And there's one more question. Look at you. Make it awesome.
Okay. Well, my name is Carter. Thank you so much for coming and speaking to us. I'm a nursing student at Montana State. It's the profession that prioritizes autonomous definitions of autonomy. And so I have seen my profession do an excellent job at discipling my cohort. I have seen views twisted over the years to prefer certain views that they don't even know how they're being persuaded that direction.
Yeah.
I thought of, as you're speaking, John 17:17, sanctify them in the truth, your word is truth, a prayer of Jesus. Mm-hmm. How do we answer that prayer today as the church in using how you've been talking about truth to address how you mentioned earlier the deficit of discipleship, particularly in our young people being raised up in vocations and being discipled by universities?
Critical. What are you doing again?
Carter.
Carter. It's critical, Carter, because I was sitting across the table from a Christian woman who's just absolutely brilliant, and she was talking about conflict, controversy, and questions. And she made an interesting statement. She says, everyone always gets all their questions answered eventually. Someone's going to answer their questions. Either they're going to answer their own with half-baked information, or someone who has misinformation will answer it for them. Or they'll come to a knowledge of the truth. Discipleship's not an option. It really isn't. It's not a good idea. It's absolutely vital and necessary. If we don't have it as part of our regular church life, in multiple facets, in singleness, what does it mean to be single? What does it mean to be a single human being? To be not married? Is it biblically sound to be single? I think it is. I think it's great. If it's not, then Jesus was a sinner. Because he was single. Paul was defective because he was single. No, I don't think so. We talk about what it means to be single. We talk about what it means to be married. We talk about what it means to be a teenager, be young. The Bible actually talks about what it means to be young. I mean, not every facet of life is addressed in this book. And if we're not teaching it, then we're not discipling people. And older folks need to come alongside younger folks, or more experienced folks even. Because I know plenty of older folks who came to the Lord last week and are baby Christians. I need a 30-year-old to tell them, I've been a Christian for 15 years now. Let me help you. And we need that. Desperately need that. Because like I said, someone's going to answer their questions. So look at the medical field as an example. You have a bunch of different views on this. And there's an excellent book written by Paul Kalanithi, who was a neurosurgeon. Maybe you've read the book. If you haven't, I highly recommend you pick it up. It's called When Breath Becomes Air. It's about his memoir about having cancer. And Paul Kalanithi, spoiler alert, he dies. And it's not a fiction book. It's a non-fiction book. It's his actual memoir. His wife finishes the book. But he goes through this whole thing where he talks about how he would objectify the cadavers that he was working on. And after a while, the first thing you do, and maybe you experience this in nursing school, when you're there and the body is there and you're in gross anatomy and you have to make your first incision, you almost want to apologize to the body. Like, I dare not violate you this way. But you volunteered, you gave your life to science, your body to science, so it's okay, you get over that a little bit. And then shortly he said, halfway through gross anatomy, you find yourself putting your elbow in the guy's head. Or leaving a, or you know, putting a thing in, like he said, that one thing he said where they put the blade up in the guy's abdomen and they made the Jaws theme song out of it, like, duh, 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 because it was a shark or something like that. They quickly made him into a mechanism. So the first thing they saw with the dead body was something sacred. Eventually, they dehumanized it so they could work on it. He says, in part, that's a coping mechanism because we don't want to believe we're working on a human being because then the enormity of it all almost crashes into you. You can't deal with it. Like, oh my goodness, what am I doing? And so then you have a patient, and if you make them a patient as opposed to Sally, it becomes very hard to take that home with you. But if you dehumanize them, well, you're basically an expensively educated character. But it loses meaning. Let me finish with a story, if I could, if you don't mind. My wife and I were having dinner with a very successful doctor. Crazy successful. He had opened up all these urgent care clinics all around the area, just was driving in Ferraris and Lamborghinis and all this stuff. But gives crazy to charity, too. Does missions overseas all the time. All the time. So my wife and I having dinner with him, and he was from a different worldview than Christianity, and then became an atheist. He left a God, belief in God for atheism. So my wife, you know, it's funny, but the non-apologist is the one that asks the best questions. She said to him, so we're cleaning, washing dishes and all this, and she says, what gets you up in the morning? What excites you about life? What inspires you? What an excellent question to ask somebody. And he said, very magnanimously, oh, people. Helping people inspires me. And so I wanted to burst the bubble, so I said, why? And he says to me, he looks at me like, what do you mean, why? Like, as if the question was an obvious idiocy on my part. why? I'm curious as to why, because we just had a discussion about how you believe we're just complex chemical machines, and yet somehow helping people inspires you. Can you clear up the confusion I have? Because you just said we're complex chemical machines. How are you part of a noble calling of people who come to other people in the time of their deepest physical need and minister them in a holistic way and treat the person as opposed to being an overly educated mechanic? Which one are you? And he didn't like that. We had a very good discussion afterwards, and you know what, at the end of that, here's the interesting thing, because it pervades all professions, Roger. I said, you know what the interesting thing about this is that you thought I meant mechanic in a pejorative sense. I don't mean that at all, because mechanics aren't just mechanics either. When they fix your car, they're helping you do something. When they fix your plumbing, they're helping people. They're not just fixing plumbing. They're contributing to someone else's positivity of life. Because if you truly feel that people are made in God's image, everything you do, and Paul said that whether eating or drinking, you do it with the glory of God, and you consider someone of equal value to yourself. Without it, it's just a way to pass the time. But with it, it's a way to glorify God. We need that discipleship so we can all see once again every single thing we do glorifies it. Thank you so much for your question. God bless you all.